Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to our latest episode of SpondyCast. Today, our guest is Dr. Zacharia. She is a pharmacist and nutritionist with a focus on implementing solutions for functional medicine and personalized nutrition. A graduate of the Ernesto Mario School of Pharmacy at Rutgers University and the University of Colorado Skaggs College of Pharmacy, she has spent 20 years in community pharmacy practice. After developing an interest in nutrition, she earned a MS in nutrition from the University of Bridgeport and subsequently qualified as a certified nutrition specialist, as well as an Institute for Functional Medicine certified practitioner. Her practice focuses on a multidisciplinary approach, working both one-on-one with patients, as well as creating implementation tools and systems for scale. She is also faculty at the Integrative Medicine Program at George Washington University, a guest instructor for functional medicine at Lecom College of Pharmacy. She's a passionate about gut health and the prevention of reversal of metabolic, allergic, and autoimmune disease. There is power in community, working with pharmacy professionals, nutritionists, and other clinicians to leverage their unique expertise to amplify the message of personalized nutrition and FX Med. And we are going to talk today, I'm so excited, about nutrient depletion in spondyloarthritis and maintaining overall health. So, Dr. Zacharia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is exciting. We were talking in the green room about the guts, and I think this is what I like to think is the next wave of how we are going to like solve our problems. Can you tell me how you ended up here?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking about this the other day. When I was in my 20s, believe it or not, it was a couple decades ago, I had some significant joint pain. I was probably in my mid to late 20s. I had just started to work in retail community pharmacy. So I was on my feet all day, 12, 14 hour shifts, you know, typical healthcare. You don't like get a chance to go use the restroom. You're, you know, scarfing down your food at any opportunity you get, you know, and like basically surviving on caffeine. And at the time I was doing like energy drinks, and I would be like eating pretzels and protein bars thinking, oh, it was so healthy because at least I resisted the box of like munchkins or something like that, you know?
Right.
And that was my life. And I was a former dancer. I danced through college. I considered myself an athlete. I was still working out a couple hours a day. I still am also a snowboarder. And, you know, I just really thought I was like at the top of my game, but yet my joints constantly hurt. And I was eating ibuprofen like it was a snack food. Like it was just how I got through my day. I didn't even think about it. I would be taking 200 to 800 milligrams just constantly. And it wasn't until I hit my like late 20s, I was about 27, 28, my stomach started to hurt. I at first assumed it was probably stress. I eventually get to the doctor, and the doctor basically, you know, does her assessment, goes, well, you're too young for really it to be anything. You probably just have a little GERD. It's a little stress, and, you know, maybe cut back on the ibuprofen. I was like, what do you mean cut back on the ibuprofen? Like, I don't take that much ibuprofen. And it was an eye opener to realize that I was that young and in that much pain. It wasn't really, and that wasn't even it. That wasn't even what got me to stop to really investigate what I was doing or what was happening in my body. It wasn't until I took a yoga class and I was literally crying in downward dog because my ankles and my wrists hurt so much. And I literally just sat there and started crying. I could not believe I'd gotten to the point where I thought I was taking such good care of my body and it was failing me. Now, I don't have an autoimmune disease. I currently I'm not in pain. So I don't claim to know what it's like to have an autoimmune disease that is so debilitating to your joints and to, you know, that causes pain on a regular basis. However, that was what was the eye-opening moment for me to start to really dig into and figure it out. That instigated a snowball effect where I just started to investigate everything. And that's actually how I ended up learning about nutrition. That's what was the spark for me to go get my master's and become a board certified nutritionist. That's why I started talking to nutrition at every chance I got, to the point where people were like, all right, already, like, fine, like we'll start thinking about nutrition. And that's what really got me down the road of functional medicine and to where I started to understand the relationships between things like the microbiome, things about chronic inflammation, how fragile really that balance is. And I think about a lot how often those things are ignored. Those early signs and symptoms are ignored, and we sort of just live with it. It just became so second nature to manage my pain in that way. And had I not stopped at that point, I don't know what my gut would look like. I don't know what other issues I would have had. I don't know what other conditions that would have snowballed into. So I'm grateful to be here now, but and not in that state. But it really was a big turning point for me.
No, that's amazing. And your skin looks amazing, which is usually the result of good nutrition. For those of listeners who cannot see. So really interesting. And I think probably a lot of people listening, myself included, I've been in yoga where I just have to quit. Yeah. It's like, and part of my journey was changing my nutrition and changing my status in the disease, I guess, yeah, if you will. Yeah. So what nutrients, like for NSAIDs and DMARDs and other drugs, like what nutrients are people most depleted in?
So a great question. I'm going to zoom it out a little bit. Because first, let's introduce the idea of drug-induced nutrient depletions, because I don't know that everybody really is aware of that, right?
No, I was fascinated by your
So happy to hear that. Yeah, so let's talk about it. So as the name implies, these are nutritional depletions that become an issue as a result of the use of certain medications. So when we think about nutrition and nutritional repletion, the classic way to think of it is you either have a nutrient or you don't. Like you either have anemia or you're fully stocked up on iron. You have a deficiency of B12 or you're good on B12. And it's not quite so binary in the real world. Our biochemistry is quite dynamic and it's holding space for all these multiple mechanisms happening all at the same time. And so it's sort of borrowing and using and leveraging these nutrients in all these different ways. And it could kind of ebb and flow in terms of its needs. And it's going to reprioritize those needs depending on what stressors are happening for the body. Also your genetics and how quickly or slowly certain biochemical mechanisms operate. And if there's anything that might be taking extra, kind of adding to that stress in a certain category, and one of those things could be medications. So a classic example, I start with the ones that are less controversial. A classic example is the use of statins and how they deplete CoQ10. Very well known, very well understood in the literature. Another great example that might be a little bit more applicable here is methotrexate. Methotrexate, classically and very well known to deplete folate. In fact, to the point where we always usually dispense methotrexate alongside a folic acid or methylfolate of some sort. That is a great example of a classic drug-induced nutrient depletion. Now, that said, we don't have a ton of research about drug-induced nutrient depletions. To begin with, we don't have a ton of research about how nutrition impacts medications to begin with. And even more than that, we don't have a lot of information, particularly about newer drugs. So the ones I'm going to highlight are going to be the ones that I know that we have evidence about.
Yeah. One of the questions I always ask myself,
yeah,
because I have heard this, like, we don't know that there's evidence that if you take a statin, this is the depletion.
Yeah.
But, and I'm picking on statins.
Yeah.
But for example, if you're taking one drug and they have to, like, if you're taking one drug and they have to give you another drug that works on the depletion of another part of your nutritional system or your system,
yeah,
like, isn't that the back-ended way? Like, I always call it treating the treatment.
Ah, so the question isn't necessarily always, does it impact that mechanism? The question is, do we need to treat that depletion? And that is core to the allopathic way of thinking about nutrient depletions. So,
and that's traditional
medicine. That's the traditional conventional Western medicine approach is, do I have to treat it? Is it significant enough to treat it? Look, when you zoom out and you look at the history of nutrition, it is a baby science. Compared to medicine, it is a baby science. Pharmaceuticals are kind of young, but they actually even piggyback on herbal medicine. So even that has an ancient wisdom and a history to it.
Sure.
In fact, we derive a lot of our modern pharmaceuticals from understanding the mechanisms of those herbals, statins being one of them. Red yeast rice is how we understood how to develop statins. So it's a great example there. We'll keep picking on statins. The difference is that in the way what we approach allopathic medicine, particularly in the way we approach the research around pharmaceuticals, we want to know if we need to develop a drug to then counter that mechanism, right? So methotrexate is a great example. We decided in the guidelines of the way that we prescribe it that the folate deficiency was so significant that we have to replace the folate when we prescribe it. With statins, that's not part of the prescribing protocols. In fact, that's kind of contested whether or not there actually is a need to always give a CoQ10 with a statin. There's reasons why you may not. I'm in the camp of why not give the CoQ10 if we think that that could be protective. It's such a powerful antioxidant. We already know that's part of the mechanism of the statin to deplete it. Why not go ahead and protect the mitochondria and protect that person's metabolic function in that way? That's not necessarily an allopathic piece. And that goes back to understanding nutrition on a spectrum. That goes back to understanding that nutrition is not binary. It's not you're completely out of CoQ10 or you're completely perfectly replete in CoQ10. That there's actually a vast continuum in between absolute deficiency and a need for supplementation and fully thriving and having the optimal amount of that particular nutrient, right?
Yes.
So we don't study that. There's not funding. And I encourage anybody who feels the way we do about this, please start talking about this, because the only way we're going to get research around this is that we all start advocating. So to all my colleagues who are interested in this topic, please let's start advocating. Let's start working together to develop more research around this topic. But at this point, the research, if we're going to be evidence-based, which we always strive to be, does not have a lot of power to it yet, right? So I can't speak, for example, to nutrient depletions and biologics. We don't fully understand it, frankly. We barely understand how the biologics work, frankly. So we need a little bit more emphasis there. But where I would actually encourage us to continue to shine a light, and I think we can still do a lot of good, is number one, talk about the ones we do know. We use NSAIDs a lot. We use pain management a lot. We use things like methotrexate, sulfasalazine. We understand the impacts there. And let's zoom out and let's start thinking about ways to protect gut function, to improve nutrient absorption from our diet, to target supplement. Let's start thinking about the more functional aspect of the way our immune system handles those nutrients. How do we optimize? How do we turn that lever up all the way so that we're optimizing the way our immune system is interacting with our metabolic function?
Yes. That would be amazing.
Let's do it.
I'm in. We start Tuesday. Okay. We ride at dawn.
Amazing. So let's start, like, can we start with NSAIDs as a great example of this? Because I do think it sort of like helps us kind of see that full picture. Because number one, NSAIDs very well known for the damage that they cause to the GI tract. We saw it in my example, myself, like just a 5 years worth of chronic NSAID use, and it was already wreaking havoc on my GI, right? We know that chronic use of NSAIDs leads to GI bleeding. We know that chronic use of NSAIDs could also upset the microbiome balance, which is a really important aspect of managing inflammation and autoimmune disease, period. We also know it shifts the stomach acid and it shifts the production of digestive enzymes, which is ultimately going to impact a whole lot of different nutrients, but very specifically, it can impact the absorption of things like B12, iron, right? Really crucial nutrients, very basic foundational crucial nutrients, in addition to that larger sort of picture of impacting nutritional absorption and nutritional utilization.
Yep.
Right? So my approach is always like, okay, well, I'm not going to tell somebody who's in pain to stop taking an NSAID, right? But how do we manage the inflammation more upstream? How do we start to think of the inflammation rather than a deficiency of ibuprofen or a deficiency of naproxen? How do we start to think about it as to what's causing that inflammation, what's causing that pain? What's happening in terms of the inflammatory response? What's turning on that signaling? And why is the signaling that's responsible for neutralizing that inflammation, right? Those resolvin mediators, why aren't they turned on?
Right.
Right? So to me, that's the upstream approach. It's yes, let's acknowledge the depletion. Let's go ahead and start measuring somebody's like folate and their, you know, B12 and their iron. Let's just regularly check people's nutritional status and nutritional profile. Let's not dismiss their stomach pain and just give them a, you know, OTC antacid or a PPI or something like that. Let's start thinking a little bit more holistically. Let's actually improve their pain. Let's reduce it. Let's reduce the reliance on the ibuprofen while we also address their gut function, their dietary absorption, and target those nutrients if we need to.
That's it. That's all we have to do.
That's it. So simple. That's
not
it.
Not a biggie. No.
Not a biggie. I mean, if you really want to get into it, like there are probably a little, you know, it's beyond that, right? Because there are a few different nutrients that we have to think about. We have to think about, for example, vitamin D, which people probably, yeah, bone health, sure. But vitamin D is like the conductor of the immune orchestra.
Right?
Like
you... If you could only hear me since when September 1st rolls around in the Midwest, I talk to people every day, my kids, have you taken your vitamin D and fish oil yet today? And they, anytime they'll say something to me all winter, I'll say, well, are you taking your vitamin D? Because if not, it's going to show up at your doctor's appointment.
Jill, how are we not friends? Because that's all I do starting on September 1st, all the way through March. And all I talk about is, did you check your vitamin D levels? Did you check your vitamin D levels?
And, you know, and it's crazy because it's hard to remember and everything. And
yeah.
I used to feel like I compelled to take it at night. And my doctor was like, just take it with your coffee. Who cares? Like it will get into your system.
I would argue that's when you should take it. Because if we think of vitamin D as a hormone, your circadian rhythm, your morning hormone is your vitamin D, your evening hormone is your melatonin, right? So it's actually the counter of that. So I would argue the best time to take it is in the morning. So have it with your coffee. Absolutely.
But like the vitamin D thing is, it's out of control, the epidemic. And I say it to employees when friends of mine come to me and they're miserable. I'm like, are you taking your vitamin D? And
you did might you remember to take your vitamin D? Is that why you're so cranky today?
I'll be like, I've actually had friends go, well, my doctor said it's kind of in range. And I'll be like, well, what does your B12 look like? And I don't get medical advice. But when you look at it, it's like, well, if you're at the very low end of the range for everything, you can't be feeling awesome.
Again, going back to the continuum. And that range, remember, it's a population average. So number one, it's just the beginning of where we think you should be to avoid disease. It does not take into account, number one, what it means to thrive and to actually be optimal and to have all the resources your body needs to actually be in balance and be in check. And number two, it also doesn't account for your particular biochemistry and what your body, so you might need a little bit more than somebody else, right? Or you might need it in a particular form or a particular dose, right? So all of these variations have to be taken into consideration. You can't eat your vitamin D. You can. It's hard though. Like you have to eat like a lot of sardines and you have to eat like salmon with the bone and you have to take your mushrooms, stick them out in the sunlight, let them like really build up their vitamin D and then eat that. And even that has to convert from D2 to D3. So it's hard to eat our vitamin D. That's a fun little trick. I love it. But your body still has to convert it from D2 to D3. And D3 is the most active form. And again, depending on your genetics and your physiology, you may not do an awesome job converting it, right? Huh. You need your kidney and your liver to be optimally functional for that to happen. Not all of us have 100% operating, you know, kidneys and livers, right? There's different reasons why supplementing might be what you need. You live in the Midwest. You live like me in Jersey, where it's like cold and dank, dark most of the year, right? You need to consider what those levels are. And I don't think that could be emphasized enough. You mentioned omega-3s. That's another one. A lot of people in the U.S. don't like fish. They just don't want to eat it. I'm never going to force anybody to eat something that they hate, hold their nose and like suck it up.
I know.
I'm not going to do it. I'm just not that kind of nutritionist. So that means that you're going to have to commit to taking a great fish oil, right? Maybe an algae oil could work, but fish oil to me is the optimal, because what happens is those fish, they do all the work. They eat the little algaes and they convert the essential fatty acids from ALAs and linoleic acid, and they convert them for you in their little factories to EPA and DHA. And those are our anti-inflammatory fats. And because they're doing the work, we don't have to do the work. Humans aren't as efficient at making EPA and DHA. So if you really need to optimize your levels of those end products, you need to be eating fish and or taking a fish oil. So
you just swig out of the bottle some mornings.
Or you can squig out of the bottle. And honestly, a high five to anybody who loves cod liver oil, because that's even better, because you're getting your vitamin D at the same time too. You're getting vitamin A in there. Some people, again, they can't stand the taste, the flavor, the idea of it. It turns them off. I just want you to like be consistent, and however we can work together to make that happen, I'm stoked.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I have a question. Can I go like in the weeds?
Yeah, please. Let's keep going.
So, and you and I could do like 10 episodes.
I feel like we can talk all night. Like might be dangerous.
This might be a double double. Okay. So one of the big questions I have looming from a nutrient depletion standpoint is GLP-1s.
Yes.
Can we talk about that a bit?
Of course we can.
Okay. So, and I'm going to share, maybe overshare, but I turned 50. I gained some weight. I was like, please, can I get the GLP-1 or semaglutide, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's one of them. Yes.
Same buckets.
Yep.
And after 2.5, 3 months, I was like, I'm miserable.
Oh.
I don't feel like myself. I'm not eating right. I'm not putting the right nutrients in. Mm. Yes. Did I lose 12 pounds? That was great.
Yes.
All of which I have effectively gained back in 5 weeks since stopping it, but might be my fault. But my question is, do we know obviously if we're not consuming food, that's not helpful. There is other things going on with GLP-1s, which I imagine cannot be good for your gut biome. Yes. And I mean, I'm a believer, right? Like, your gut dictates your neurotransmitters. And like, I was like, I feel depressed.
Yeah.
I feel in 4 weeks, I feel like a new human.
That's so fascinating. And I love that you noticed that you weren't fueling your body.
Yeah.
Because people miss that. Can I tell you an anecdote? It actually just happened this weekend. I was speaking to a family friend, happens to be a physician. And he was asking me about GLP-1s, and he's already prescribing GLP-1s. He works with mostly men, and we're talking about, you know, the most concerning side effect is sarcopenia, muscle loss, which is a big one, especially if we're talking middle-aged to older adults who might be starting on GLP-1s. The sarcopenia can be even more significant and more stark. And if we're not layering in adequate nutrition to address that, we're not making sure they're eating enough protein, we're not encouraging them to do weight resistance training, all of those things, that could be really significant. And he said something that I thought was really interesting. I said, you know, I made a comment that yes, in addition to that, I notice that folks don't tend to be motivated to eat healthy anymore. They see the weight dropping. They no longer feel it necessary to pay attention to how much fiber they're eating. They're not paying attention anymore. Are they eating a salad today? They don't want to fill up, frankly, on higher fiber, higher density meals, right?
I couldn't. I would eat like a packet of plain oatmeal every 2 days. Otherwise, yeah. I had no room. I would feel sick to my stomach.
And that is probably, yes. And that's and probably, made, not, it's not everybody. Drivers. Yes.
No, I was going to say,
that's probably on the higher end of the extreme. But to some variation of that, I'll have somebody say, well, I know I need to eat my protein, but I don't have room in my belly to eat the chicken and eat the salad. So I'll just pick at the chicken, right? And now they're not eating the salad anymore. What happens when you don't eat your salad? You don't eat your color. You don't eat your fiber. You start starving your microbiome. Now, one of the side effects of GLP-1s is also shifts in motility. That means that your motility starts to slow down. That's part of the reason you're not as hungry. And that's why, Jill, you were feeling so full and you couldn't eat anything. That's part of that effect, right? It's turning on the satiation pathway in your brain and telling your brain, I'm full. I can't fit anything else in my belly. Because literally,
what,
you can't
move it through. Is that dopamine?
Well, it's interesting you're thinking of the dopamine. So dopamine is that kind of feel-good hormone that helps us feel satiated. Very often we're chasing dopamine when we're chasing a lot of like sugar highs or something like that. But no, it's actually more specifically leptin and ghrelin.
It is. Okay, so it's the V-shred guy. He's right. Yes. He's been right for 10 years.
Yes.
Okay.
Right? So it's because we're turning on that hormone pathway that's now shifting your perception of your fullness, but it also literally is slowing down your motility. We have a peristalsic effect that basically it's like a little massage that comes down your digestive tract. And that massage, that peristalsis moves things down. It moves food through your digestive tract. And when that slows down, you just can't move things along. When that slows down, it also starts to impact your microbiome in a different way, right? So now you're not eating your fiber. Your stuff isn't moving through like it should. You're possibly not even pooping as often as you should. And that's a real red flag for me, right? That's okay. So that sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar.
So all of this is starting to then impact your nutrition in general, right? So imagine you're on this for like a month, 2 months, 3 months, all the nutrients that you normally would be eating down tanked, right? Your microbiome tanked. To your point, all the neurotransmitters, all the serotonin and the dopamine and the melatonin and all the things that we make in our digestive tract because of our microbiome tanked.
Yep.
So what's that going to do? You have no energy. Your poor little mitochondria are starving, right? Because we're not giving the body the fuel it needs. We are so kind of, so going back to my story, I sort of make this observation and I basically say, people feel like they're not invested in what they're eating anymore. And so it's really challenging to coach folks who are seeing the weight loss. Yay, I'm so excited you're losing weight, but I really need you to eat more vegetables. And they're like, well, I just don't feel like it. And honestly, I'm not that motivated to eat them anymore. So what happens? If they're on the GLP long-term, what happens when they stop the GLP? They never developed good eating habits. They never learned to eat healthy, again, because the motivation to do so was never there. So you either are going to kind of stick with that kind of same fiber poor, color poor, nutrient depleted diet, because that's all you know how to eat to maintain the weight loss, right? Or you get off the GLP-1, you go back to the old eating habits, and you gain it all back.
Right. And this is, you're making me think, right, there are three, what is it called? The behavior change wheel, right? Opportunity, motivation, and capability.
Exactly.
And I think I know this didn't turn out as we thought it would in this episode.
We did predict we would go down some rabbit hole. So here we are.
The capability piece, right? And don't get me wrong. I have heard stories of people, and I don't want to trash GLP-1s because I think they're like
100%
game changers for people.
Absolutely.
Probably like my peristaltic response, we'll just call it that in a fancy way, is what screwed it up. And I'm hearing more and more of like people I know with chronic issues going down this road because it is hard, right? We also have like joint pain and this and all the other things. So you want to, but like you think about the behavior change wheel, opportunity, like that, that's what GLP-1 presents is opportunity. But we don't have to adhere to the learning the capability of the long term.
There's no, there's a phrase, pain comes change, and it removes the pain point that motivates some people, not everybody, but motivates some people to change their behaviors and their lifestyle and dietary habits. And so it removes that. And what I really want to do is I want people to stop thinking of GLPs as a cure-all. We have this kind of habit in our society that we look, we see a solution and we assume it's good for everybody. And we need to go back to treating GLP-1s the way we treat every other medication. If you don't need it, you don't need it, right? If you have a if you have an issue with that mechanism, if you have issues with the balance of your insulin, your leptin, your ghrelin, your GLP activation pathways, you probably would really benefit from it. And you won't see a lot of those side effects that we're talking about here, right? Because what it's doing is rebalancing and recalibrating that imbalance, right? But if you don't have those and your hormones are operating well, you probably won't see a benefit. I mean, you saw the weight loss, but it's not going to be a sustainable benefit. And you're going to probably experience more of the side effects and it's going to be a riskier investment for you.
Right.
I will make a comment because there is some interesting evidence out there that low dose GLP can be useful in some folks because of its anti-inflammatory properties, and it
that I've heard,
some mitochondrial function, but that's low dose. So just like we think of naltrexone, low dose naltrexone, naltrexone and low dose naltrexone operate very differently, right? They're going to do different things.
Or like methotrexate, right?
Right, right. So again, the low dose component is really important because it's doing something a little bit differently at a subtherapeutic dose that is going to act and behave in a different way. So that's a different conversation.
That's kind of cool though.
That's a different opportunity.
Right. This is where maybe it helped. Okay. I would buy that.
Yeah. And again, that's still new. We're still exploring that. I would still argue, you know, dip your toes in with some caution, but there's probably a place for somebody who might be experiencing weight gain, who might be experiencing, your gut isn't in a good place. I would say if you're that person that has constipation and GI issues and IBS, I would, you know, I'd be a little bit hesitant to go in that direction. If you're pre-diabetic, this might be an option for you. If you're experiencing joint pain, this might be an option for you. So it really, again, goes back to this crazy notion of a personalized approach, right?
Boom, you landed the plane.
And let me add one more thing. You know, you mentioned you turned 50. Happy belated birthday.
Thanks.
And I think menopause. I was just going to say, well, this one of is the things right? we don't talk about is menopause.
Right.
Perimenopause starts 10 to 15 years before you actually land that plane in menopause.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
So yes. Those fluctuations in hormones from your late 30s to menopause, to an actual, diagnosed menopause.
Yeah.
That in and of itself not only can shift your immune system response and change the way your autoimmune disease shows up, it also changes the way your body holds on to body fat.
Oh, yes.
Shifts your metabolism, right? And your digestion.
All of it. Yeah. And it's your, like, it's everything. And I'm making notes to send to Jason on like, can we do an episode on menopause? Cause we haven't.
You absolutely have to. I'll be the first one. Yes. I'll be the first one that's sitting front row and center for that.
Things that like, I actually had a conversation a few weeks ago with someone, this is way in the rabbit hole, but a recently like divorced male who's talking about, you know, having his next partner. And I said, well, it doesn't really matter. Cause once you start dating us at like 38 or 39, you just got to like buckle up for menopause. And he's like, what? Like, I don't really even understand that concept. And I was like, how could you not understand that concept? You've got to have a perimenopausal wife.
Because it's 2024 and we're just now starting to have an open conversation about menopause, and we're now starting to see research around hormone replacement therapy and how menopause impacts various diseases, metabolic function, autoimmune disease, et cetera. We're just now having that conversation. So I think a lot of the things that we sort of dismissed as, you know, flukes or what's wrong with me or being, frankly,
women are
gaslighting. Exactly. Yep. All of that is now starting. It's like the aha moment of, those are normal hormonal fluctuations. And look, let's back up and just say, like, there's a lot we can do. There's lifestyle changes that we have to really impress. There are, you know, factors like, making sure that we're using like herbals in a way that can really help support hormone function and balance, supporting our adrenals. Our ability to manage stress in those years is not what it used to be. And it's not what it's going to be once we cross the line for menopause, right?
Yeah. It's
putting the ball down, pulling the ball down and actually allowing time for rest, which is not often something most women in our society have the opportunity to do. Right. And then on top of all of that, what's the role of hormone replacement therapy and what does that look like through that process?
Well, and this is something I've been thinking about. I've been doing the last 4 or 5 weeks since I decided I needed like emergency 911 to my system.
Yeah.
The first thing I did was like take a week off and do like 4 hours a day of yoga and meditation. And one of the things I'm like thinking is, right, like, and I don't know if you're a meditator, but when you get into, okay, one of my Ayurvedic practitioners, she talks a lot about like at the end of the day, right? We move through our system, all our systems come together and like it's pee, poop, period, out, right? And you think about that in context to, we're going to get like yogic here, but your chakras, right? You want to like, you have to move everything out. And we know like a lot of our energy comes from those areas, but we don't want to talk about them. Maybe we're going to do like a 10-part series on the peas, especially for middle-aged women.
The peas for middle-aged women. That's the title. Yeah. Done. Put it in the books.
I was thinking about this in my yin yoga. I was like, I'm like trying to get like, okay, how do I get like my lower chakras to open? I'm doing all these heart openers. That's great. But like, how do you get your lower chakras? And it's like what you're eating, what you're drinking, how it's all moving through your system and what your nutrients are that support all your various systems. And it is very personal, right? Like I think this is where functional medicine and personal, like this is where it's all moving.
Yes.
And exactly. The more information, and we were just talking the other day within spondylitis group, a group of some of the board members about like, this is the future. If we can figure out, and you said it, right? Like you get your, and we're going to go, I'm going to bring us right back into out of the weeds. You get your results back and you're like, oh, my B is a 390, but 400 is acceptable for, and you're like, but I can't feel my toes.
Right.
So don't tell me it's acceptable.
Right.
So, but is this personalized medicine, and some of new panels, I mean, is that something you're seeing in your work?
Yes. I want to go back for a second and I promise I'm going to come back to this and it ties in. But you said something about, you know, the chakras piece and the sort of moving things out. You know, from I think an Eastern perspective, you know, we could think of it as energetic. And if you've ever done sort of that type of meditation where you think through the chakras and you sort of think about how to light them up as you're inhaling and exhaling through, that's not so different than basic metabolic function, right? So even if you are not an Eastern practitioner, you're not into any of that stuff, you have to be into kidney and liver function, right? You have to be into the concept of lymphatic drainage and lymphatic flow and the purpose of lymph, right?
Right.
And the idea that everything that we're taking essentially is process, it's information, whether it's food, whether it's oxygen, whether it's stress, whatever it is, we're actually taking in that as information and it's getting metabolized by a body in collaboration with, as we're learning now, our microbiome, which turns out has been doing all the translating of that information and talking to our genes and helping to activate our epigenetic expression of it. So that's the scientific explanation of what the energetic sort of Eastern understanding of metabolism is.
I love the translation.
Yeah.
Lens.
Yeah. And this is why I think my prediction is in 5 to 10 years, we're going to start seeing the microbiome as its own system, as part of our body. That's just another piece of who we are, that we're like a symbiotic relationship, but like more, like we can't really live without it. Right. And so honestly, we probably are more dependent on the microbiome than it is dependent on us, because we require it for everything. Its metabolic process is what activates our metabolic. That's why we talk about short chain fatty acids. Those are essentially, that's bacteria poop. That's bacteria eats its little food and then it poops out short chain fatty acids. That postbiotic goes back into our system and communicates with our neurotransmitters. It communicates with our DNA. And again, that's what epigenetics is. It's taking the programming that we have, our DNA programming, and it's taking in the messages that our bacteria poop is then translating for us. And it's, I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but essentially that is what says, turn off this gene, turn on that gene. And in the case of autoimmune disease, it's saying, oh, there must be a danger out there. We must protect this person at all costs. Let's turn on all the inflammation. Don't stop until I say go.
Wow. Sorry. I'm like, but this is fascinating.
I couldn't agree more. Now, how do you quantify that in an 8-minute medical visit? That's the question. So is this where we're going? Yes.
Right.
Do we have currently the tools in our system to apply this at scale, to take every single piece of data from every single person? We have trillions of bugs, right? How do you quantify that? We're just scratching the surface and understanding this relationship and how that's communicating with the plus you add the added complexity of our DNA and our environments, right? And our unique physiology. This is going to take a minute for everything to catch up, for us to really figure out how to do it. Now, you've got the people that are very pro AI saying, hey, with AI, we're going to really expedite this. We're going to be able to crunch these figures very quickly and be able to translate that to really personalized approaches for people. I'm optimistic, right? We're not there yet. We don't have that capacity yet.
I mean, that this is a whole nother episode, right?
I'm 100%. And we don't need to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah,
but
I've been
basically saying
with a firm in Europe on data privacy.
Yes, exactly. So a whole, it was a can of worms and that. Yeah. So, but just sort of saying like, this is sort of what we're dealing with. So yes, do I think that we're moving in that direction? Absolutely. I think we are getting there. I'm more and more, look, 10 years ago, I would be at, you know, a general conference, and I would talk about the microbiome and I talk about leaky gut. And I was like the weirdo with the tinfoil hat that was like, oh my gosh. Laughed out of the room, right?
Yeah.
Fast forward, I can go to any academic conference and we're talking about the microbiome. We're talking about intestinal permeability. We're talking about the gut brain access. We're talking about the gut kidney access, right? We're talking about all of these interrelationships. Right? We're finally talking about pharmacogenomics and nutrigenomics beyond just sort of like this idealized approach, right? That there's this perfect solution to use that information in some sort of prescriptive way, right? We're getting there. We are getting there. It's just going to take a little while for us to kind of move that needle forward. And this is why I think it's really important for patients to start to understand, start to self-advocate, to take the evidence that we do have, the practical information that we have now, and start to apply it, right? Those foundations are never going to go away. The important parts are never going to go away. We might hopefully have tools that help us to put fuel on the fire and help to get us there faster. But right now we know we can help to really co-manage autoimmune conditions, reduce inflammation, improve pain management with these foundational strategies. And for each one of us, we might find a little bit of a different solution, right? That is going to work a little bit better for us. Things that you know are non-negotiables for you, other things that you know you can let go of on the busier days. But at the end of the day, I think it always kind of go back to the core, right? I told you I used to be a dancer. So in ballet, we say, go back to the bar, go back to the basics, right? That's what it comes down to. Yeah.
That's it. Okay. One thing I want to touch on And we should wrap up so we can get just shy of two episodes, and then we'll book another episode. For people listening, because what I don't want to do is scare someone into thinking they're nutrient depleted, but are there a set of warning signs that your body would give you awareness to potentially?
And that you might have a deficiency? Sometimes. I wish I could say that there's always clear signs.
Right.
Very often, by the time you notice a symptom, you're probably quite depleted. So I'm going to start by saying the first thing we can and should do is screen for nutritional deficiency. So going back to that idea of let's get some lab work done. Let's do a better job at testing our blood chemistry specifically for nutrition, right? So a lot of times patients will come to me and be like, oh, my doctor already did my labs. They said there was nothing wrong. I was like, okay, that's cool. I still want to see them because they're not looking at them to look for any nutritional depletions. They're looking at them to make sure you don't have a certain disease. And you may not, but I might see some patterns that might indicate that you might be low on certain nutrients, or that might signal that we should maybe dive a little bit deeper and see if there's something worth exploring there, right? So that's number one. Let's do a better job of using the blood chemistries we have. And number two, let's start digging a little bit deeper. I think it's kind of silly. Vitamin D is not standard. It's not a standard blood panel. Your doctor has to go out of their way to ask for it in most institutions. That's number one. So advocating for a vitamin D panel, easy peasy. Number two, iron. Iron is not a standard thing that we check for. What we usually do is get a CBC, and you can diagnose anemia with just a CBC. However, you can actually see if there's any evidence of inflammation, chronic infection, or iron deficiency early on by getting a iron panel. Super simple. It's usually really cheap too. Your insurance may not like it. You might have to pay a little bit to pay out of pocket depending on your insurance and how strict they are. But another really simple nutritional panel that we could just add on. You mentioned folate earlier. You get a folate at a B12. A homocysteine is like extra credit, right? Because homocysteine is also associated with mental health, cardiovascular risk. And it's because it is dependent on B12, folate, and B6 to be in range. It's also part of the process that we have for detoxification and for reducing oxidative stress by making a really important antioxidant called glutathione. So it could give us some clues as to how your body is metabolizing and how it's potentially getting rid of toxins. It's not going to give us the full picture, but it's a great clue, right? So those are really just basics. From there, you know, we could get fancy. We could get selenium levels. We could get zinc levels. One of my favorites is an omega-3 to omega-6 profile. That gives us an idea of what your balance of omega-6 to omega-3 is. I mentioned earlier, it's really hard for our body to make EPA DHA from its precursors, right? We're not, humans, not great at it. Fish, phenomenal at it, right? That said, we very often will overeat the omega-6s and undereat those omega-3s, and that is a driver of inflammation. So that's a super simple test that we can get to see if we need to rebalance and recalibrate that.
DHAs. Okay, we're going to take that offline, but I think there's some interesting stuff there.
Yes.
From one of our previous guests who is like she said she checks DHA in patients when they are having low sex drive.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah. Was
she
really
thinking
interesting
about neuroinflammation?
What's that?
She thinking about neuroinflammation?
I can't remember. I'm going to go back and listen to it. It was Iris Zink. And I want to, like, I think she was great, but she was talking about it, and it may have been, okay, we're going to go back to that because it's the first time.
Now you got my brain going, and also just let's get back on track. So that's the basics. There are some fancy labs that you could get into. There's some functional lab testing available. There's things like organic acid testing that we could do. We could do full fatty acid panels. We could do full amino acid. There's so many great labs that we could do. But I think that's kind of that starts to now get into like costs, that starts to get into what you have access to. And I think the other piece of it is how well is your GI functioning, right? So I often will advocate for stool testing that looks at how well your microbiome is balanced, how well your digestive function is. Are there any inflammatory markers in your gut? Do we have to address that head on? And when we think about the functional approach to autoimmune disease, it often starts with addressing the gut, looking at specifically how to power our mitochondria, or the powerhouse, or the factory, the energy factories of our cells. And then how do we balance those nutrients as well that are needed for our immune system to sort of get back on track and get back into balance? Did that answer the question? I don't even remember the question.
I think the question was, what are the early warning signs?
And again, they're data, right?
Like you don't, maybe we don't know ourselves. What
I do want to talk about other warning signs actually. So testing is the ideal approach. And like I said, I sort of say like, sometimes once the signs come into play, you might be like, we could have caught it earlier. Basically, ideally we would check your labs and we would sort of nip it in the bud there. However, things like fatigue, this is why I think iron panels are really important, right? Differentiating if you have a thyroid issue or an iron deficiency anemia. And if you have an autoimmune disease, you often will be at increased risk for other autoimmune diseases. So that could be something like a Hashimoto's or an IBD or anything else that might get to potentially also impact this whole metabolic picture too. So that's why I think it's really important to sort of track those factors that could influence a very common symptom like fatigue. B vitamin deficiencies can also lead to fatigue. There's physical warning signs, hair loss, changes in hair texture or hair thinning, changes in nails, first fragility in the nails, then I would say the thinning of the nails, and then any changes in terms of ridges or spooning where the nail bit starts to flatten out a little bit. We call it spooning because it like almost like it, when it gets really severe, it almost looks like you can pick something up with it. These are all nutritional deficiency related symptoms, right? Neurological pain, headaches, right? These could be very general, right? But very often mean that there's likely some sort of B vitamin imbalance or deficiency. I have seen cases where that's due to some sort of genetic issue, right? So folks that might have an MTHFR mutation or a COMT mutation might be at increased risk for some of these. So they might experience these symptoms when those are at flare. Incidentally, folks with those types of genetic SNPs sometimes are also at increased risk for certain autoimmune diseases too. So there's sort of a relationship there in the way that your body kind of can handle the nutrients that you have in your system to run all this biological function goes hand in hand and how well it can power your immune system. And your immune system, arguably, you know, top three, your brain, your immune system, and your heart are the most expensive energetically systems to keep running, meaning that powerhouse, that energy factory, the mitochondria, a lot of the ATP that it makes goes into running that operation. ATP and energy function, that is metabolism. Metabolism runs on cofactors that are nutrients. So all of these things come together basically on the expense of how well and how efficiently your body can produce energy. And that's where the nutritional piece comes in. That's where the optimizing nutrition comes in. So it's really going upstream here. Once you can get that nutrients in the right balance, you ideally have all the resources to make the right energy and power those mitochondria. Then the mitochondria makes enough ATP that can balance and power that immune system. And alongside some other nutrients and some other factors like the microbiome can then help to balance that immune response. Make sense?
I'm rarely speechless. That was amazing.
Thank you.
I have so many thoughts in my head that it's unbelievable because I think this is so important. Although I will say, like, I feel like your early warning signs are describing menopause.
Well, I know, you know, but that's the thing. It's like, is it menopause or is it depletions or is it menopause feeling worse because you had these depletions, but they're less obvious? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no, totally.
It's vague, but sort of like there at the same time, if that makes
right.
sense. Yeah.
Well, we're all onions, right?
Yes. Yes. And I will say the other thing, and I don't want to harp on this, but I think it's so important. That kind of like the thread here between perimenopause, menopause, and immune function is stress. It's like the number one kind of triggering factor, right? And again, our resilience and our ability to take the ball and run with it, handle multiple things, multitask, outperform, you know, everybody else, right? Like do all the things, be that reliable person, be the backbone of the family, you know, all of those, the emotional labor that most of us have to carry day to day, that starts to decline as our hormones start to shift. It's almost like the body is saying, I need you to sit down for a minute so I can work this stuff out. And our adrenal function and the hormones related to our adrenal function, as well as our thyroid function, are going to be at max capacity during this period. And what we rarely have the opportunity to do, particularly in our late 30s, into our 40s, into our 50s, juggling work, family, all the responsibilities, is to have that moment to sit down. And so it's not crazy to me that that is going to really pull on those resources. And that's why a lot of those symptoms are going to start to show up more blatantly. Because I always think of it like these are superficial things. Like I always joke, like people come to me for superficial reasons, but at the core of it, there's something deeper. They come to me because they're losing hair. They come to me because their skin doesn't look great. They come to me because their energy is not awesome and they're not performing as well in Pilates or whatever. But really at the core of it is all these other imbalances that this superficial stuff is starting to crack, right? And so I think this is a reminder to be gentle with our bodies as much as possible, to start to speak up for ourselves, to start to say no, to start to be a little bit more assertive in what we can and can't handle and in delegating responsibilities and really honoring that rest that our body is asking for.
Yeah. And I think it's, I'm going to steal it from someone else who was a guest with us, but it's like finding what fills your cup and doing that.
Yeah.
And it's not easy, but you're right. There was, what was I watching? Oh, I was watching a rowing video last night. The guy was like, I'm going to give you 7 days to kick out, you know, whatever. But I'm watching it and he said, if you're going to do rowing to lose weight, you have to ask yourself, I'm going to do this because, and he said, and until you can answer the reason you're doing it for yourself, yes, keep asking the question or the reason you're doing, you know, what you're doing it for. And when people ask me things, I always like, I'm doing this because I want to feel this good when I'm 80, right?
Yes.
That's my standard answer. Yes. Right now, I want to feel better than I feel right now when I'm 80. But I think those are the things that we do have to give ourselves the rest and the peace and the,
yeah,
and especially those of us with autoimmune stuff, right?
Exactly. It's true for everybody. It's all. Also, especially true for autoimmune disease, and also extra, extra true for those with autoimmune disease through going through perimenopause and menopause.
Yes. Okay. Well, on that note, I think that leads us to like episode number 2, 3, and 4.
That's your teaser for that menopause episode. Teaser,
yes. What did we miss? There's much going on in this area that like this. Yeah.
I feel like, honestly, we can talk about this forever. You know, if I had to, I think the things that, you know, we started to talk about specific nutrients and things like that. I kind of want to zoom out and just sort of give like my overarching prescription. Obviously, this is very general. Everybody's is going to look a little bit different. But I want to sort of really like nail this point home that whether or not your autoimmune condition is managed with medications or not, whether or not your medications are working, right? Regardless of what the status is there, if you're in remission, if you're still in an active autoimmune phase, there's something that could be done from a lifestyle component that can help support that. Let's not minimize sort of the impact that that has. We want to think about factors that reduce systemic inflammation, right? We start with the gut. We talked a little bit about how the GI impacts inflammation. So starting with really feeding the gut, I talk a lot about eating the rainbow as like a super simplistic way of giving it the fiber and the color and the polyphenols and the antioxidants that it needs to really function optimally. We talked a little bit about omega-3 fatty acids and whether you're eating your fish or you're supplementing EFAs, those omega-3s and particularly something called SPMs or pro-resolving mediators are really important when it comes to balancing that immune response. And then thinking about directly supporting that microbiome, things like obviously probiotics and prebiotic fibers and things like that, but eating them too, like eating fermented food, traditional foods like sauerkraut, kimchi, et cetera. If those suit you, you tolerate them, you like them, those are great for the microbiome and could be a really great part of that anti-inflammatory prescription. I think it's also important to think about general nutritional optimization, the things I sort of, again, there are certain drug-induced nutrient depletions where we started this whole thing, right? There's certainly drug-induced nutrient depletions, and we focused a little bit on sort of the anti-inflammatories, but depending what else you might be taking, that could impact your gut, your microbiome, your nutrient absorption, as well as specific nutrients. So addressing those directly can be a very, you know, simple, low-hanging fruit. But I think even expanding out, making nutritional assessment a bigger part of your annual, you know, assessment or annual visit. In most states, you can actually request your own labs. And in fact, there are some great options in terms of programs and companies that are allowing folks to get their own functional panels as well. So that's an option, or working obviously with a provider that can really guide you. But know that there are options out there to do a better lab assessment to get your nutrition levels. And that way you could target it. But even starting with a basic multi, I like multi minerals and then adding a B complex and then targeting things like vitamin D, for example, if we need to. So that's sort of like how I like to start as a foundation. I like things like greens and antioxidants because they're super easy to add into your daily routine, and they help support antioxidant levels, glutathione levels, they lower inflammation. And then of course, omega-3s are a great add-on there. And magnesium. Magnesium is a must go to. If it's not in your multi, you should be taking magnesium. And then all the other factors, stress management, we talked a lot about sleep, exercise, all those basic foundations have very direct, very measurable, tangible influence on both autoimmune, inflammatory function, and of course, overall well-being. So I think, again, finding your way there, picking sort of one of those threads and following it would be my way to go, and personalizing it so that it works for you. And above all, that it's doable, it's sustainable. It's not adding more pressure or stress on your life.
Wow. Okay. Do you have a blog or something?
I do. I do. I have a blog. It's just my name, larazacharia.com. And I also am very active on social media on both LinkedIn and Instagram is where I'm the most active. And I talk about all the stuff all the time.
Okay. So we're going to include those when we publish this. But I just want to say thank you. This was such a refreshing conversation about a lot of this. And I'm sure people will get as much out of it. And I'll apologize now for anyone who has been waiting for an hour for the specific medication, but
I tell you what, I have a blog on drug-induced nutrient depletion. So if you really are interested in that, I have a blog of the most common drug-induced nutrient depletion. You can go and read it there. But to be honest with you, I think at the end of the day, when we think about drug-induced nutrient depletion, just because you're taking a medication doesn't mean you're depleted in it anyway. So just because I know you could be depleted in something doesn't mean that you are, because you might be taking all the precautions, eating all the foods, doing all the things, or just your biochemistry may not be as impacted, right? So we talked about statins and CoQ10. Not everybody actually is depleted in CoQ10. So we have to honor that too. But I think the best takeaway here is that's a great starting point. Let's investigate that as a low-hanging fruit, but then let's take it to the next level and start understanding how these nutrients impact our physiology. I don't think because a lot of clinicians aren't trained in nutrition, I don't think a lot of them are having this conversation at this depth. Just like the example I gave of that of my colleague that is a physician that's prescribing GLPs, it hadn't occurred to him to think about the actual quality of the intake. He said, oh, they're eating plenty of protein. They're still, you know, sarcopenic. I'm like, yeah, but they're not eating any fiber. Do you see what's happening there? And it was just he did not make that connection, right? And I think that goes to show, again, let's advocate for, more nutrition education across the board in healthcare curriculum. But if you're interested in more about drug-induced nutrient depletion, I talk about that on the blog.
Amazing. All right. I'm going to land the third plane, and thank you for your time. And we would love to have you back. This was fascinating.
I would love it. This was so much fun. Thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation. As rambling and meandering as it was, I think you did a great job landing it.
Yeah, we landed it well. We had a great time. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lara. And we will see you soon.
Thank you.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.